40 had, in our terms, a wide intellectual periphery. Stalinism was a very powerful force in this country, far more powerful then than Trotskyism. They outnumbered us 10, 15, 20, and 30 to 1, if not more than that. But there was this period of the revulsion against Stalinism when a whole section there was of the radical intellectuals, and there were a wide layer of radical intellectuals in the 30s who considered themselves part of the Trotskyist periphery, literary figures, intellectual figures, academic figures. Trotskyism was, so to speak, fashionable in many intellectual circles in this country in the late 30s. The principal focal point for these circles was the magazine Partisan Review, which was then a very serious literary and political publication of a very high quality. Such people as Edmund Wilson, Mary McCarthy, Philip Roth, the Trillings, Diana and Lionel Trilling, James T. Farrell, extremely John Chamberlain, the critic, extremely eminent and able and gifted intellectuals, considered themselves in general sympathy with Trotskyist general ideology and certainly with Trotsky himself, for whom they had a tremendous admiration, not only as this very romantic figure who had led a revolution, who was ousted, exiled, continued the struggle from exile, but who had a very real appreciation for Trotsky's not insignificant literary gifts. There's a very good book I'm fond of recommending about that period, which I think gives you an excellent picture of the whole social milieu in which the New York Trotskyist movement functioned. It's written in the form of short stories by Mary McCarthy, who was in the center of that milieu. It's called The Company She Keeps. And while they're written as short novels, short stories, all of them are based on facts. Many of the characters are easily recognizable and discernible, and they're about this whole intellectual milieu in which I say Trotskyism was quite fashionable at the time. And it really gives you, it's a good supplement to reading In Defense of Marxism and the Struggle for a Proletarian Party to get the viewpoint from one of the people in these circles who were having this impact and this effect and this influence on our movement. Their association, I say, was largely with Trotsky, I think, more than with Trotskyist ideas. And that was quite spread in this whole periphery of our movement. At the time that Trotsky was assassinated, for example, if you'll read the speech, the memorial speech delivered by Jim Cannon, you'll see that the central point of that speech was to address himself to the question, can the Trotskyist movement survive without Trotsky? And the reason that he had to address himself to that question was because in many quarters in the world, including a large part of our periphery, and I think among some of our members even, there was the question that Trotskyism without Trotsky was nothing. Within the party, there was, and Burnham, incidentally, I say, was part of this whole intellectual circle. He was a professor of philosophy at NYU. I believe he was assistant to Sidney Hook, who was the head of the philosophy department, and who at that time considered himself a socialist, too. And Burnham was a very respected figure in this intellectual circles, and he was a gifted man. You read some of his early writings when he was in agreement with the political program of our party, and you'll find some of it extremely worthwhile. If you can find his pamphlet analyzing the Popular Front, another pamphlet, War and the Workers, several other things, extremely well written, very capable. So you had this formation within the party, which was not only middle class and social composition, middle class in the milieu in which it functioned and lived and was influenced by, but also with a particular political background. Most of the members of the party, particularly in New York at that time, and New York along with Los Angeles were the two principal centers of the opposition, most of them had been recruited either from the Communist Party or from the Socialist Party. You know, the Trotskyist movement had entered the Socialist Party for about a year in 1936. We emerged from it much larger than we went in, recruited many people, but the education that people got in the Socialist and Communist Party was not quite the same as the education that you get in a Marxist movement, and it proved to be a handicap for many of them insofar as their political integration into our movement was concerned. In addition, you had a particular problem within the youth movement, and that is a fallacious notion that what was decisive was not the party, but the youth organization, that the youth was the vanguard, that the party was a bunch of old fuddy-duddies. You know, it's all right to have them around. They paid the rent. Some of them had a job, you know, at the headquarters. But the youth movement, that was really the revolutionary movement. They had very little respect for the party as such, for its traditions, its leadership, its program. They considered themselves in advance of the party, more intellectually knowledgeable, more revolutionary, more devoted to the struggle, etc., and so on. Now, this had a certain basis for development. When they were in the youth movement of the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, they were dead right in their assumption. The youth movements there really were the vanguard, and the parties were a bunch of reformist old fuddy-duddies from whom they had nothing to learn and whom they had to fight if they wanted to do anything of a revolutionary character. The problem was when they brought that attitude into a revolutionary Marxist movement, it created a problem of relationships. And there was this whole tendency of youth vanguardism, which added to this whole picture. In addition, in my own opinion, and this is something that I saw only in aftersight, so to speak, in hindsight, looking back on it, and seeing the difference between the youth coming into our movement today and the youth who came in then, I think a large part of the difference is that they were the locked out generation and that they came to the revolutionary movement more by necessity than by choice and commitment. Not that they weren't committed when they joined our movement, but it was in a different way. This was a period of depression. You had to have a college degree to get a job as a sales clerk down in Macy's in New York. Things like that. It was the locked out generation. There was no future for young intellectuals in the bourgeois world. No careers were open to them. Society offered them nothing but war, fascism, depression, etc., and so on. And many of them, including some extremely capable and gifted intellectuals, turned briefly to the revolutionary movement. But then as soon as things got a little better, as soon as the war period of prosperity came in and the jobs started opening up and things weren't so tough for intellectuals, we began to see this very rapid exodus from our movement. I remember I was in Newark at the time, and our youth movement in Newark, which had all of these features which I've described to you as that obtained in New York, or most of them, included also this phenomena of these very gifted intellectuals who had so little actually to offer a revolutionary movement. The principal leader of the opposition there was Leslie Fiedler. You probably read about him or read some of his stuff. He's the guy that was a professor. He was framed on a pot charge by the cops up in Buffalo, I think. Melvin Tooman, the historian, was a member of the group there in Newark. Another went on to be a fairly well-known professor, Herb McCluskey. A whole group of really talented young intellectuals. I don't think they were in the movement more than 6 or 8 months when the Shachtman opposition developed, and they just joined right in. And they went with Shachtman, and they went out with Shachtman, and they went through the Shachtman movement like a dose of salts. I think within a period of 2 years, they had just gone right through the whole business. Now, just to make the point about the difference between then and now, young intellectuals who join our movement today, maybe it's starting to change right now, but as of the past several years, did not join the revolutionary movement because there was nothing, no opening for them in this society, because they were locked out, because they couldn't be a part of the society, but rather from a conscious decision that while they could be a part of this society, they didn't want to be. In other words, people consciously rejecting the life, the career, and the possibilities that are open to them in the bourgeois world, seeing it for all of the rottenness that it is, the fact that it's not worth what it takes to get it, and consciously putting in their lot with the revolutionary forces that proposed to get rid of this rotten society, even though many of them had the possibility quite easily, to one extent or another, of becoming part of it. To me, this is a basic difference between the young intellectuals who have come into our movement over this whole past period and the young intellectuals who came in then. I think as I look back on some of the young people who came in and left us then in a different kind of a period, might have made the grade, and some of them could have been very good revolutionaries. Well, in addition to this, there were forces at work in the party in terms of its opposition to its program of developing significant differences. There was Burnham, and along with a man by the name of Joe Carter, who had presented this resolution in 1937, questioning the class character of the Soviet Union. If my memory serves me, they also at that time raised the question of the organizational character of the party. I wasn't able to check back on it, but unless I'm mistaken, maybe Bill Kitt back there would remember, they raised a question that had been raised in 1903 by the Mensheviks in the fight with Lenin on the character of the party. That is, they proposed that membership in the party be based on agreement to carry out the discipline of the party and not necessarily on the basis of agreement with the program of the party. That's my memory of the way that they raised it, but I could be wrong. It was quite a long time ago. So you had Burnham, and then who was developing this very conscious theory about a new class force arising in the Soviet Union. You had Shachtman, who had been one of the founders of our movement, and who said he did not agree with Burnham either on the question of the class character of the Soviet Union or in Burnham's rejection of the dialectic, but that in the concrete he agreed with him that in the struggle between imperialism and the Soviet Union, that something new was involved, that it was not a matter of defense of the Soviet Union, and therefore it was incorrect to raise the slogan of unconditional defense of the Soviet Union. Then, in addition, there was this whole special, curious phenomena within our movement, which was known as the Ahern clique. And there's a whole section in Jim Cannon's book on this, which is well worth studying. Cliqueism is a problem in this society generally, and it's a problem like all other social problems that to one degree or another, at one period or another, manifests itself even within the revolutionary movement. And on local scale, on national scale, at one time or another, cliques have existed within the Socialist Party. That is, people bound together not on the basis of any particular common political outlook, but simply on the basis of mutual friendship, chumminess, as it's called, and so on. The Ahern clique was the most significant, the most extensive, and almost the purest case history of what a clique is, and Cannon examines it at great length in the struggle for a proletarian party so that people would learn and understand precisely what the nature of a clique is. Now, It was a petty bourgeois milieu in the party at the time. Another prominent figure, young at the time, considered a very gifted young intellectual, he was only 17 or 18 at the time, was Irving Howe, a right-wing social democratic... Well, he was not much more appealing then. I remember I was in Newark, going into New York, decided to go to the big city and attend the youth meeting over in New York. And they were having an educational discussion being led by Irving Howe, and a big debate on the problem of political morality, Bolshevik morality. And the question was posed by Irving Howe, as I remember it. We had just come out of the Socialist Party then. He said, supposing you knew that one of our opponents in the Socialist Party had committed a class crime, like crossing a picket line or something, but you were the only witness, and it was your word against his, and you couldn't really prove that he did it, would you have the right to tell the party that he did it? And there was this one, you know, there's a big labor struggle going on, a big radical struggle going on. Fight with some. This was a big discussion that was going on in this meeting of the YPSL in New York. Well, I got back on the tubes to Newark, and I didn't go in very much more after that. When Trotsky characterized them as petty bourgeois, therefore, virtually everyone else in the party applauded. Let me read to you just a key point of his characterization. Right at the beginning of his article called A Petty Bourgeois Opposition in the Socialist Workers' Party. It is necessary to call things by their right names. Now that the positions of both factions in the struggle have become determined with complete clearness, it must be said that the minority of the National Committee is leading a typical petty bourgeois tendency. Like any petty bourgeois group inside the socialist movement, the present opposition is characterized by the following features: a disdainful attitude toward theory and an inclination toward eclecticism, disrespect for the tradition of their own organization, anxiety for personal independence at the expense of anxiety for objective truth, nervousness instead of consistency, readiness to jump from one position to another, lack of understanding of revolutionary centralism and hostility toward it, and finally, inclination to substitute clique ties and personal relationships for party discipline. It was a very apt summation of the characteristics of this group. See, what is the principal characteristic of a petty bourgeois individual, a middle-class individual, who does not make a conscious decision as to how they are going to lead their lives as revolutionary? The whole conditioning of a petty bourgeois is precisely individualism, particularly in the United States of America. The hallmark of the petty bourgeois is to make it. To make it as an individual and to make it at the expense of everyone else, and that's your only hope for making it. When you boil it down, that's what all of the American way of life is about. And someone who is completely conditioned by that outlook, even though they come over to a socialist point of view, finds it very difficult to develop the capacity to subordinate themselves as an individual to a larger movement. For them, subordination means somehow stifling some aspect of their being, stands in the way of realizing themselves as an individual. The petty bourgeois, because of his whole condition of life, who has to make it as a dentist, as a lawyer, whatever it might be, may have an association, but essentially he's got to make it as an individual, finds it very difficult to grasp that the best way that an individual can develop is through a collective effort, and that in fact whatever forward motion there has been in society, whatever real development there has been of individuality, has been through collective effort. The individual was supreme in the cave, but it was not much of an individual. It was only when people came out of the caves and began to band together that they began to develop as individual. And that's the whole meaning of socialism, of course, that only in a collective society can the individual be free and can the individual develop. Well, in anticipation of that, the same thing holds true in the revolutionary socialist movement. The individual can develop within the socialist movement, make a contribution both to the movement and to the enrichment of their own personal character, personality, what have you, only to the extent that they are capable of becoming part of this larger social organism, the party. And that, I say, is something that has to be thought out and understood very consciously by someone whose whole background and training has been the opposite. It's one of the biggest obstacles for a petty bourgeois individual to overcome when they cast their lot in with the revolutionary socialist movement. To understand that simple fact that the best way, if you want to grow and develop and realize yourself as an individual, is to develop the capacity, it's a dialectical concept, you might say, a certain contradiction, to develop the capacity to subordinate yourself to something larger than yourself. By subordinate, I don't mean in the bourgeois sense, in the sense of becoming a creature, etc., and so on, but becoming part of something, an active part of something that is larger than yourself and offers you the opportunity, therefore, to grow and to relate to things more meaningful than small individual things. So this is the problem of the petty bourgeois who remains petty bourgeois in their outlook, and this was the problem, essentially, of the petty bourgeois opposition, of the cliquists, and so on. Working class people, while they are imbued very often and very deeply with petty bourgeois ideology, and many of them have the same ideas, making it and so on, have a different experience in life which conditions their thinking differently. A worker in a steel town or an auto town, a rubber town, doesn't have much realistic thought of making it as an individual. Most ambitious thing is maybe, you know, you can save up enough money to open a gin mill or a body fender repair place or something and get out of the shop that way. But nobody working on an assembly line has an idea that if he works hard and he's ambitious and clever, you know, that he's really going to become a big success in life and is really going to realize himself. His social consciousness, her social consciousness, is developed by the reality of their social condition. The workers can see from what's around them that their only hope is through collective action. That's why they have union consciousness. That's why when they become revolutionaries, they can understand more easily the need that the very best thing they can do is to become part of something larger than themselves, and that's the best way of assuring their own self-interest. Well, I've talked over my time. I've still got more. I'll deal with it in the third lecture. Why don't we stop right there and have some discussion.
Before we get into the discussion, I want to remind people about